feeling out there, it's not sunny, but you know, that's pretty good.
It's particularly the sunny girls, I don't know where they came from, but they must have paid them until about 12 o'clock because they disappeared very quickly. Anyway, we're here to talk about one of my favourite games, actually, Medieval 2, Tug of War. I've got the distinguished honour of introducing Dr. Ken Turner from Creative Assembly. I'm also a big fan of Sega, particularly Sega Europe. Some old friends there who I've worked with in the past. And I think they're very progressive now because Sega Japan has actually given them a lot of scope to go out and do their own thing, so which is a significant move for Sega Japan because traditionally, obviously, they've had some great franchises with Sonic, etc., but they now realise that if they want to be a global player, they have to build more and more Western-centric product for want of a better term. So I think that the combination of Creative Assembly working with some very proactive people in Sega Europe is a good thing. But anyway, that's enough for me. I'd just like to introduce you to Ken Turner.
Hey guys, how are you going? Looks like we're having a nice cosy session today, which is good. As mentioned, we're going to talk about the journey that was Medieval 2 and still is Medieval 2 today. From mostly a programming perspective, but in these days, we're going to touch on a few other things too, some of the marketing, the commercial aspects, and all these things that have an impact on the decisions that we make as we write lines of code. I was going to actually, my first question was going to be, how many people here have actually seen Medieval 2? And mostly half the people here work for us, so this is going to be a really, really interesting discussion for those guys. So let me see if the magic of this PowerPoint thing will actually work for you. I was up all night trying to get this to work. Getting the buttons on here took a long time. It's rendered out frame by frame, but every effect you see and every unit you share in the model is actually in game. So, there's a little bit of spooking there, a few awards along the way. But essentially, for Medieval 2, it's a combination of two games in one, which makes it a very large problem. It's actually probably more like four games in one. There's a campaign, there's field battles, the river battles, and the sea battles, all of which have a different kind of take on it. And zooming down from the whole of Europe to actually see in pure 3D detail with flowing motion animations and full sequence together, and we'll actually touch on some of the combat today to create the epic war simulation which I will wear. The game also takes different seasons and different climates all the way down into the deserts and the dark sea, even across to the Americas. And elephants as well. All in all, there's 21 factions and 380 different unit types in the game, so and 34 different settlements, and the game is just kind of massive from a data point. So I don't think we're going to be touching on some of that stuff today. I've got some other goodies to go through. So just having a look at where Medieval 2 has managed to get to. We set out at the very beginning to run a very tight product and project. It came in on time, on budget. It has high quality, in low defects. It's getting very, very good reviews. It's actually higher than we were expecting initially. And outstanding sales as of this week. We're number one in both the US and the UK PC charts, which is fantastic. And especially as of Thursday night, we've got a few more awards. So thanks to the team for that as well. I think we took out best graphics, best gameplay, and best PC. So well done to the team on that too. Though I did get in trouble for not thanking our wives and partners in the speeches. So if you ever bump into them, just let them know that I've said it now. So what I want to go through today is a number of bits and pieces, things that we found were important on the journey that through Medieval 2. From the very first thing of really just setting the goals and the expectations. If you get that wrong, well, then it's actually very hard to call that out, whether it be between the design department, the programmers, or whether it's the publisher and us as the developer. We're going to have a look at some of the key features, the things that we targeted as back-of-the-box items for Medieval 2. We'll go into a little bit of detail on what is happening behind the scenes there as well. One of the massive things we had to deal with was actually using legacy code. We started Medieval 2 with the Rome code base. In fact, the last pickup that we took was the Barbarian Invasion. There's a lot of getting up to speed there, and we'll go through some of the issues there. Some of our processes and practices that we found were good. Just recently, we've been consulting with some agile guys, and it turns out that we're doing some bits good and some bits not so good. And we hope to improve that for our next stuff. And then we'll wrap it up with a summary. I wanted to actually start talking about the goal and the aim of the project in a very general sense, in that especially here in Australia, we are an export business, so whenever you sit around, you kind of cook up your ideas for what you're going to do as a project, because they take a long time and a lot of money to do, so you want to make sure that you're making a good bet. Always make sure that you look at yourself not as in comparison to the other studios around Australia or any of that sort of stuff, but what would actually make an impact on the global market. And it's a scary proposition. It's very humbling, but it's also, I think, something that grounds you quite well. The other thing that I touched on before was make sure that you manage everyone's expectations. Set the project and the team up for success. That everyone is on the same page about what you're actually trying to achieve. And on Medieval 2, we actually started with almost 50 cups over that one thing, just to make sure that the minimum bar was set, the minimum goals were such that the team could easily achieve those, and anything over and above that is a success. And we should essentially celebrate that and reward the team for that, as opposed to, why didn't it get 95? Surely it's the one after Rome. Rome got 92. That kind of rubbish we ever deal with. There's no one from Sega here, is there? And the last thing is really, when you're looking at these things, be bold and courageous. Look for something that might be beyond what your team is capable of, or because generally what you find is that a team's skill level and their potential is generally not lined up. People have a lot of room to grow, and so. Taking a few chances on a few things which aren't necessarily critical to the whole product can mean that later on you've got some sparkle, you've got some sizzle. I've put trap shooting down here because it was an analogy that I gave to one of the Sega producers at one point, because he was accusing us of underplaying what we were doing. That we were suddenly doing all this stuff that we'd never told them about. And I said, it's a bit like trap shooting, in that you've got your shotgun and we've walked up and we said we're going to hit 4 out of 10. And they agreed that 4 out of 10 was good, and we just kept on hitting. A lot of it by good planning, a lot of it by just sheer good luck, and sometimes through finding the right person to actually become part of the team, to bring the skill set in that we needed. So, you know, a lot of the success of Medieval 2 going beyond what I'm about to show you as our initial goals that we set out is through to the team rising above that initial thing and actually shooting a few more play pigeons. 2 years ago, and a bit, we got together after Rome and we were looking to put together a project to be solely done in the studio down here. At the time, there was 10 of us, and I think we were estimating that we would need 28 in order to do the project. It ended up 60 if you include all of the part-time QA guys, so it was quite a good community by the end. We set out initially to have a sales of half that of Rome was at the time. You know, there was a good chance that it may be seen as a derivative product, and that if our clay pigeons didn't get shot, it would have probably just looked like a little bit of a dress-up. We also, so in terms of reviews then, you know, looking at that, we were targeting 80 to 85, so competent, well executed, but perhaps something would be missing that would allow the marketing guys, which obviously, you know, and the media who do all the review things to, there's something missing for them to grab onto initially. The other thing that, you know, not to kind of speak too much out of school, we wanted to make sure that we wanted to show that a Total War game, even as massive as it is, could be actually delivered on day one with a really good street quality. We focused especially in the early days on multiplayer desync. You know, we invested a lot in tools and logging and some automated testing that I'll talk about later on as well to try to keep us honest as we went through that, because, you know, bringing it all together at the end, which is what has happened on the previous Total War products, has led to a disaster of six patches later proportion. So we wanted to make sure that we put our eye on the ball and went through all of that. Also, we wanted to take some time out of that, what is generally a short development cycle that we had for Medieval 2, and make sure we had time to polish. Generally, the Total War games have been had features added to them right up to the death, and that has meant that they've gone out either, you know, low quality to begin with, but also there's no time to actually balance on top of those mechanics that we're doing. And the last thing there was to obviously establish and grow a studio here and get a full complement. We started with some programmers, some audio guys, a couple of artists, and George, who basically does everything else, you know, including cleaning the kitchen. We still don't have an office person yet to do all of that, but that happens soon. Once we had the goal, we wanted to really establish a focus, you know, something that the team could look at, because the stronger the focus is, the more that every decision that every person at every desk makes every day is going to be in the direction of where we want to actually take the product. You know, so our positioning for the product, which actually came out halfway through it, so I'll give you the initial positioning, which popped up just before in a minute, is one for the fans. We're not looking to extend the customer base. We simply wanted to take the existing customers and give them the experience that they've always wanted in Total War. And for that, you know, we started to be a lot more customer intimate with them. You know, we actually started asking them and listening to them about what they wanted. Surprisingly, one of the things came out that, oh, look, just these core mechanics, just fix them. They didn't want new features. They didn't want all of this other sort of stuff, apart from multiplayer campaigns, which, you know, is a complete nightmare. Apart from a few strange things, all they wanted to do was say, just fix this up and balance it and we'll all have a great time. The other thing that we did is actually grab some of these guys and hire them in, so that on a minute-by-minute basis, if we ever lost focus about who the fans were, we could go and talk to one. You know, hugely valuable. The joke around the office is that I can't stand to look at another one of these Total War games. You know, I've kind of worked on Rome and now Medieval 2. I fully appreciate the value that we give to the customers, and I am excited about Medieval 2, how it came out in the end. Through the tough times is when you need to call on these people. Our original focus was for the development team, which is all that we had at the time, so that we didn't embark on a great R&D and refactoring exercise, was to say that this was actually just going to be an 80% reviewing incremental version on top of Rome. Internally, we called it a patch and a mod. And we did that for the first 8 months of its development cycle, so that we didn't get lured into thinking that we should take something which functions generally okay and is probably good enough to ship, but we've got a better idea and somehow we're going to, you know, launch the space shuttle with this new way of doing it. It'll be so much cleaner. The customers will love to look at our code. Oh, hang on a minute, they never see it. So just to keep everyone honest, we did that. So fix it, because we've worked out that we couldn't actually go through and fix everything. I'll talk about the legacy code base later on with a few stats, and it's astonishing. So, and on top of that, we chose to do a few new features, but do them spectacularly well. Yeah, put all of our energies into those, on top of making sure that the base that was already there is solid as. The other thing too that has been lacking from the previous Total War games was a focus on content production. These are very, very large games, and so in order to take the visual quality to the next level, we had to invest a lot in tools. I have a very tools focus. The programming team, through the patch and mod phase, was also drilled into them that they were a service provider. They were there to help the content providers get their stuff in the game, to help the designers realise those ideas. In the end, the programmers ended up on the critical path again, so that it always kind of works that way, but at least it got us through those first couple of months. Okay, so just taking stock of where we're at, that's all I really wanted to talk about today on setting goals and you know, setting the focus. And you know, once you've got that kind of crisp, describe it in a sentence, well, then the team can go away and be right at their desk. Right now, we're going to move on to having a look at some of the key features, the headline apps that will be added to Medieval 2, to try to get people excited about the period, which is an exciting period of history, probably one of the most popular, as it's turning out, from our fans. The first one is the removal of the clone armies. You know, no more every soldier in the unit going to have the same haircut, the same beard, let alone the same skirt. You know, the next thing was, you know, we really wanted to take the combat. You know, there's an opportunity to really zoom in and get a really good bone-crunching experience, a cinematic experience, but that was kind of lacking from the dice roll rule system that was in Rome and in previous games. Another thing that we added, because, you know, what's Medieval all about? It's about knights and it's about castles. So we ripped out the entire settlement system from Rome and built it from the ground up inside the new graphics system. So, yeah, and there was certainly some teething problems with that. And then really just the cool graphics in general. So that we've, you know, got the movies, we've got the screenshots, and because what our customers told us was they just enjoy the experience. You know, don't underestimate the fact that people just like to go to these places and be there. So even the hard-nosed, hardcore guys love the fact that the game looks spectacular. So, gameplay over everything else, well, you know, I don't know how that's going to go, especially in the next gen and the graphics card explosions happening at the moment. Okay, so this is just a screenshot that I pulled off the network somewhere. You know, clearly you can see that each of the guys has different shields and different helmets and all that kind of stuff. They've actually got different weapons as well. There's a facility in the game to independently update their armor level so that they actually, you know, look different that way. So it's all very mix and match. It's kind of, I suppose, if you took your Lego men and pulled them all apart and then plugged them all back together differently. That's the way the system works. It's actually fairly simple under the hood. You know, we just take the one unified VB for all of the variants that particular soldier could have, and we just put together an IB for each instance and just pipe it through that way. Very simple, very fast. And we cache a lot of these things too, so that we're not continuously rebuilding them. The second thing that I wanted to talk to you about was the actual combat itself. We took a very Hollywood stunt fighting approach. You know, there's lots of combat systems out there to do with, you know, kind of physical based, you know, when the weapon hits the thing and cuts through the leather armor and does a scratch on the surface and they lose a quart of blood and then their health goes down by a point. You know, it's not going to work in a game of this size. We've, you know, got thousands upon thousands of guys all being quite angry at each other simultaneously. So we need to kind of fudge it a bit. So, and Hollywood's really good at fudging stuff. You know, and what we realised was that if you get the timing of a hit and a reaction exactly spot on, you can actually miss physically in metres by a quite distance, and you can even be off in terms of the angle that you're facing towards them by quite a lot as well. Up to the order of you know, plus or minus a metre in the horizontal and, you know, half a metre vertically. You know, so long as, because we're looking at this whole game generally from a floating camera of at least 15 metres away, and you're looking at a sea of these guys. You know, I'm going to show you some screenshots that I had to hunt around for and stop it just at the point of contact so that we can see some of the errors. But when the game is running, it's just the sheer speed of it all, our brains interpolate that the action happened properly. And that saves us a whole heap in terms of our processing, because essentially it becomes a time-based problem now, more than even a positional-based thing. You know, it's not a physics-based thing or anything like that. Essentially, if these are the two attacker and defender timelines, essentially there's a point at which they need to agree. So if the attacker is going to hit the guy's shield, well then at that same point his sword needs to deflect as if it hit a shield, and the shield needs to absorb the damage as if it was hit. And if that happens, we believe it. In order for that to happen, obviously what I've got here is an attacker animation, which the first part of it is a commencement, which is the wind-up to the point of contact. And then after that, depending upon the result, they have a recovery. There's actually a whole bunch of different recoveries. There's a successful recovery, a failed recovery, and there's actually a recovery that flows straight into a fatality as well. For the defender, he has a commencement as well, which is essentially raise my shield in the direction of the attack. So it's generally very, very short. In 20 frames a second, it's probably you know, 3 or 4 frames long. You know, very snappy, it doesn't feel kind of slow. But what it means is the attacker, which might have 14 frames of wind-up, it means that one attacker against one defender, the defender will always block because he's got plenty of time to do that. In order for this to all line up, the defender, after being told through a messaging system that he's going to get hit, goes, you know what, it's 14 frames, I'm going to take 4 to get my shield in place, I'm just going to hang for 10. That, in the multiple attacker situation, allows him to potentially, if another person goes to attack him, he can choose to step back instead of take this one on the shield. So there's quite a lot that we've, because of this investment, we've been able to bring a lot of behaviours through the individuals, which then come out. Kind of like the ant colony methodology, you know, in unit behaviours actually emerging through that. Yeah, so that's the delay. This screenshot here is one, it's in the middle of a fatality. What we actually do is when we detect this, and if the unit is the right type and they're facing the right way and the wind is blowing the right way, they get together and they perfectly synchronise and they do a little dance. What we told the animators was you can actually make them do anything. You know, you could, you know, make them do the bus stop if you wanted to before actually, you know, lopping each other's heads off. So while they're doing that, no one in the rest of the world can kind of touch them. So you didn't want to make it too long because it would start to affect gameplay if everyone was, you know, boogieing along. In terms of the actual setup of all of the atomic pieces, we've got attacks and defences and hit reactions, you know, from all different directions at different strengths, you know, for each of the skeletons, so, you know, which corresponds into each of the weapon types and the different shield types. So there's quite a lot of anims that were plugged into this. I don't know exactly how many, but way too many to count, and plenty to bring down some of our data pipes sometimes. What we do to make sense of all of this is we actually categorise them, you know, into different zones, and the zone is kind of cut up in terms of distances. You know, we just said A through to E. They're just abstract things. They can actually be defined independently for each of the skeletons. So if you've got a long range, a longer weapon, you can actually have a different spectrum with that, which is pretty cool. And then height, low to overhead. Overhead being if you need to attack someone who's mounted, or if someone's on an elephant, which is quite hard to get. As well as it deals with being on uneven ground. And direction left, centre and right. So not only do they have centre attacks, but they could, from that one pose, attack 45 degrees right or 45 degrees left, depending upon if the animator's bothered. But all of those slots were there so that they actually do that. Just taking this as an example, the guy on the left is about to poke the other dude in the head, I think, and open him up. Just to have a look at how the zones actually would work. So, and I've kind of guessed to exactly how it would work. Generally, a C attack, so where a lot of the melee happens, so my lines probably do correlate okay. In terms of height, zero height is through their pelvis, because we all know that these guys were thinking down there, not up in their head. When I show you the next thing, we'll see why. Basically, when this guy goes to attack the poor little red dude with the stripy shield, he scans all of the guys which he can attack, both left and right and centre, he just happens to be centre, and then looks at all of the attacks that are available to him by trying to target either his torso or his head. So it's always trying to target a range, which helps on uneven ground again. So here, this guy would take those two zones as valid and then put them all into a big pool and then randomly choose one. There were quite a lot of variant slots that the animators could put into. But this whole system here was actually quite lightweight to get up and running, essentially with one attack string. And if they had no defences, they didn't defend. But you could put one defence in there as well. And you could actually populate that one anim to fill the entire table if you wanted to, and accepting the visual artifacts. This here is why they think with their pelvis. Essentially, we wanted to make sure everything was relative, so when a guy on a horse attacks another guy on a horse, they see that as a mid-height attack. It's not like, oh, I'm up high, you're up high, yeah, let's all be up high together, and have to try to correlate all of that. It also means that when guys on horses attack guys on foot, they're doing low attacks. So it was very easy for the animators to get their head around that, and it made the code a lot easier as well. This is the only case I could find with a screenshot that actually had some blocking in it. Yeah, you can see that the guy with the shield is kind of hiding behind all that. He's actually successfully blocking, which is cool. The guy with the mace on the right-hand side is swinging through, but if you're going to have a bit of a look, you know, they don't come anywhere near each other on this particular example. Now, if I'd chosen a different camera angle or something like that, you probably wouldn't have noticed. And especially at full speed, you don't notice the error. All you see is that they react in perfect time. The third thing that I want to talk about today is the way that the settlements are built. So instead of before, there are a bunch of prefabricated buildings, you see replicated buildings throughout. We took a more atomic approach and broke it down into reusable pieces of, you know, little block pieces. The blocks are all interconnecting. I was going to call it Lego settlements, but you know, if they said it gets distributed, I can't call it that. So wherever you see modular, think Lego. Yeah, and it has to be an internally consistent set so that you're able to build things that are, you know, fully 3D. Each block in that set has various LODs, it has all the damage variants, it has transitional animations between the different damage variants, it has all of the other triggers associated with, you know, burning and, you know, glowing with light, you know, be it either through being damaged, so each of the variants could actually be triggered with one of these things, or whether it's just a static light like a brazier or something on the side of a building, as well as then extra game data. So if we had an arrow tower, for instance, we can just have them put that in the block and then that will propagate through the entire game. Yeah, great if there's a bug. So this is an example of one of the largest castles that there was. It doesn't actually all fit on screen, even though we've kind of put the fisheye out to the max. On the right-hand side is the inner keep and of the fortress through three rings out to the outer of the city. So you know, assaulting one of these puppies is a whole bunch of fun. But just the sheer epic view of looking out across this big city is fantastic. And because we've used the blocks instead of actual reusable buildings, well, there's cases where they can put a little gable, for instance, you know, on this guy here. You know, something similar to that around the other side of the castle won't have that, or maybe it's somewhere else. Apart from castles, there's also cities in the game. It's one of the gameplay things that we've added. I chose this scene because it actually has quite a lot of the extra elements and emitters on it. So there's some smoke emitters there just coming out of chimneys just as part of an idle thing. Down here, it's pretty hard to see in this one, but I've got some other ones. Yeah, there's the little braziers sitting there. At night, yeah, they all glow, and yeah, there's dynamic lighting as people go past them. And the animators were smart. What they did is they said, look, you know, for any of these things which are, you know, kind of pretty boring and generic, like a roof on, we're just going to have it snap and we'll hide the rest of it under particle effects. But for cool things like spires and towers, they actually went through and you know, pre-processed a whole physics destruction for it. So they look really cool when they go down. Yet we don't have to run physics in the game because we've got thousands of other dudes to worry about. The other thing that you know, goes into these, you know, from Max, you know, the guys can put in all of the other game logic stuff, so traversable surfaces, pathways between doors on top of walls down to the bottom so that, you know, we can all link together, docking points for siege equipment, so and also, importantly, in the cities, some rally points for the AI for it to be able to work out what its next defensive perimeter is and whether it's going to be able to hold it or not. All of this was done through an offline processing thing that we added for Medieval 2. Rome used to process all of this on load and more. So that was the very first thing that we did do architecturally. We wanted to put in an offline data pipe. And that allowed us to do, you know, lots of optimizations, especially on the static lights, where all of the vertices in the settlement have up to four most significant static lights you know, burnt into them. And so you just have to kind of, you know, tickle that particular index. And you can, that way you can have flickering static lights and everything as well. But for those, we also calculate occlusion. So a brazier on one side of the building, even though it's got quite a large radius, won't be, you know, illuminating everything on the other side. As well as, you know, at that phase there, we do the game data extraction into the other databases. This here is a more typical scene. You know, there's lots of stuff going down, lots of dudes not being able to make it home for dinner. And yeah, and it shows a little bit of the destruction. So over here, the roof sections, most of them had both light emitters and fire emitters. So if they were hit by a flaming yeah, projectile or something like that, well, there was a chance that it would actually ignite as well as be damaged. That particular block there was a snap change. We didn't bother with any caving in roofs or anything like that because the particle effect was quite large. The other thing in this particular shot, apart from the breach through the wall, which, you know, has obviously run its course, but there's a wall section just next to it, which is in process. So that part there is actually no longer traversable, and it's, you know, quite obvious that that's the case, but and that's probably in stage 2 out of 6. I think there were different damage transitions that were all hard built by the animators through those lovely tools that do physics stuff. The docking points and everything for the siege equipment, obviously the ram over there that's on fire isn't going to be much good, but the ladders here, you know, all of those positions are actually determined relative to the block, so you just put it in one of the wall blocks and then from then on, you know, it's everywhere. A couple of things of note, apart from the tower being actually destroyed, there's a few kind of local damage points. You know, we had some blocks, we just add one variant of damage, which is almost like a surface damage, so that for every hit that you have on a building, there's some reaction, there's some cause. You know, it's not that, oh look, you need to hit it four times and then suddenly it'll go to the next damage level. Those things there is a merely superficial way, would not have changed the game state at all. But it's still cool when you're looking at this stuff and it all has a cause and effect. Just a side note that I've noticed in this one too, we actually, right at the end of Medieval 2, just to make sure that we were putting gameplay first, we allowed for soldiers to clip into each other when moving up ladders because there was a huge problem with the throughput of men climbing ladders. You know, if they just trickled up there and got picked off one by one. So, you know, we allowed it in some places so that you know, you really did get a good sense of gameplay and flow. So there's lots of artifacts around. We just hidden them, so hopefully we won't find them too much. And just wanted to show this one too, because siege tower docking was one of the biggest problems we had. You know, obviously it's a docking point on the wall, but the guys making the settlements made the terrain just a few degrees off. You can imagine 2 or 3 degrees from the ground up to the top of this 40 metre thing, and that little platform suddenly doesn't overlap the wall anymore. And we had a lot of little guys falling to their death, which was unintentional falling to their death. To get around that, we actually went through and did some offline validation. So all of the settlements and all of the docking points are checked to make sure that they're within a height differential and an angular differential for the normal at the point of the docking for each of the engines. So, and any of the ones that were no good were essentially invalidated and discarded. So the player couldn't mouse over or select any of those things in game. Generally, we also got the level editors and the designers to go back and change the terrain, either that it should have been flat or it should be so obviously steep that they shouldn't be able to go there, because we don't want really that kind of ambiguity. Just as a bucket, one of the things we did do was kind of lots of cool graphics. We're traditionally left at least one generation behind the shooters because of the scale that we need to operate at. On Medieval 2, I think we made a half step towards that. Obviously, we could never get all the way there. There's a lot of shaders that we never ended up using, displacement map shaders. And even though we had normal map support for a lot of the buildings, that the art time wasn't there to make them all, so... But still, there was a couple of cool things that we added. Late in the day, even the fake HDR bloom, really started to give the whole thing a bit of personality. The full self-shadowing model with a macro and a micro map for a high res up close, and a lovely fade transition in between. You can see it if you sit and play with it, but generally it creates a great LOD across the whole thing. We do a 2x2 sampling to get soft shadows, because we're using a depth texture for that, and a full-on dynamic light system as well that integrates with all of that. There's no shadows from the dynamic lights, but they all move generally so quickly that you're not really looking for the shadows. And one other little thing that we added to the terrain was the whole idea of untraversable cliffs as well as with overhangs, and I'll show you a little bit of that later. Not that it was necessary, but we added a full reflection system as well, so for the rivers, it's just cool. Yeah, this is just the cool factor. And we couldn't really hold back Marty V, our graphics guy. He goes, "I've done all my other work, I'm going to do this." And it was 4E3, and we went, I think we could use that. So, and then we went through and put it through everything. So initially, for E3, it was just one lake that the art guys had built. This is a river that's actually generated through the terrain generation system, and we make it all coplanar, and so that everyone plays happy. In the reflection, though, we do a huge reduction in LOD. So the terrain, which generally renders in multiple passes in order to get all the shadows and the textures on there, we've actually got a single colour map pass, which is very blurry. I think it's a pixel every 64 metres. But you're not going to see that in the reflection. All of the vegetation is done as sprites. The men are culled away after they're more than kind of 20 or 30 metres away from the water surface. And the siege engine is the same. So you can actually zoom over and watch in the reflection guys crossing the river. That looks cool. We kind of cut a lot of corners to do that. And I added this one in here too, just because the reflection just made a whole bunch of really cool game moments. This lake here is actually one that the artists can build as part of their settlement. So they go, "Oh look, I want to have it defensive for the cannon guys, so the guys inside can't sally out and just destroy them. But also, when you're there, I want it to look really cool." They could have actually put a cliff there if they could have done something else. But kind of using these things in places where people see them, as opposed to just little novelty things. I'm going to bore you with a bit of geometry now. It was something that I thought would interest at least me anyway. The way that our terrain generation works through subdivision, through different octaves. What we added, Rome was simply a height field based one. What we added to this was that each of the subdivisions actually go the minor, normal to the actual gradient that its parent was. And so if you kind of take this further through, you start to see that you can very quickly get to vertical surfaces as well as overhanging surfaces. The cool thing about doing it this way is that you don't end up with the great texture stretching of projecting everything down. Now, the texture coordinates that go with this essentially wrap around like a manifold, so it looks really cool. So we can have these great overhanging rock faces that have wonderful pixel clarity. Just so it doesn't go crazy, internally we only allow the horizontal plane perturbation of each of the vertices only get 32 metres, but yeah, you still get pretty good features with that. If you're ever thinking of doing a random generation of terrain, don't. Invest in your tools and get the artists to make 300 maps instead. In Medieval 2, we have over 30,000 maps that could be generated, and we tested probably, a fraction of that. I tested 12, so I don't know how the rest of the team went. But it means that we can make cool-looking vistas like this. Over there, you've got your cliff faces that people can't get up. They're really good defensive positions, I must make a note here that one little cool feature also meant that it invalidated our path searches, so we had to rewrite that. And so I think Dima is still on Valium and on holidays recovering, but I think it's cool. The other thing that this scene's got is it just shows the bloom, how it really gives a great kind of warmth to the back terrain and everything like that. Nice and cheap. So that's really all the key features. The next thing I want to have a look at is just a really quick thing on some of my musings to do with using the legacy code. My analogy that I've got there are the three doctors, the archaeologist, the pathologist, and the surgeon, so on. I'll have a look at what they've got to say. The very first thing that we had to do, we were presented with a very large code base. Four of us had worked on it. I just measured it just before. With Barbarian Invasion, it was 60 megabytes of source code. 60 million monkeys typing on their keyboards. And which is huge. We still, there's whole tracks of it that we didn't touch in the last 2 years. It's just massive. And it was worth a good laugh. We found some of the most ridiculous code that you've ever seen. And we had great sessions. We'd all get round to stare at monitors. And then one day we realised, oh crap, we're building a game on top of this. And then no one laughed after that. And then we started to learn about what we could do to actually get through all of this. Instead of having the default thing of, oh, look, I'm a programmer, I'm much smarter than most other programmers, therefore I'll just write it myself, you had to start looking at what other people have done. Find value in something that you know is pretty much useless, but there's things in there beyond the code. It shows you what the initial assumptions were, it shows you what the requirement was, what other systems were they interfacing with. Because unless you dig down and start to understand what their daily life was like and what this bit of code really touches and what it influences, it makes it very difficult. What we actually found was just get in and fix the bugs. Instead of complaining about them, fix them. And you learn a lot about all of these tracks and paths and backdoors into things. Rome was one big monolithic code base. So that meant there were backdoors everywhere. No libraries, no anything. Until we got to it. It's still one big lump of that, but we've got other libraries. And really, it came down to the whole tapestry thing. You pull on a thread. Sometimes you just cut something off and then see what complains. That was a good way of working out how the code base was going to squeal back at you. The second doctor is the forensic pathologist. This is the guy that really wants to get in and understand about the person who actually wrote it as opposed to just the byproduct you left behind. Was there a reason why it was written by a series of block copies? It might be. maybe they were having a bad day. It helps you find their original assumptions because, you might get there and go, look, I want to add 3% of functionality to this. And you're faced with refactor it all, or think like they did and just do a bit and then never come back to it. because we're in the business of doing something to get games out of the door. You know, the other thing is, you know, don't mess up when you get there. Because if you start putting, you know, your footprints and fingerprints all over it, then the next person who has to come along is not going to be able to get in the zone, you know, if they have the unfortunate task of having to change some of this stuff too. One thing we do, like every good crime scene investigator, is take a few, you know, snapshots and, you know, label a few things so that the next person comes along and goes, oh yes, don't step in that bit of puke. The biggest thing that we also fixed was false comments, or even worse, function names that don't do what they say they're doing. Sometimes we just put a big sign up, do not go there, girlfriend. And all of this obviously doesn't matter unless you've actually gone to the producer and said, look, we're going to refactor this thing, it's a complete mess because all of our systems rely on it and we're not going to ship without it. That's really the biggest test that we have on this. Will the game not ship if we don't refactor this thing? The last one is, if you do refactor, is the transplant surgeon. And of course, there's always a big question, you know, where do you stop cutting? Because, you know, if one system relies on another, all these organs are kind of interrelated. If you don't actually put some temporary thing in place, you know, some interface, some membrane to actually protect the data and kind of pipe it all through, you might end up cutting all the way through to having nothing left, you know, and rebuilding it. We actually had that problem. It managed to slip through all of our wonderful checksums and project management methodologies, where the terrain, the settlement system was slowly eating its way through the game from the bottom up. At no point was there a target or a safety line or some, you know, that it was going to stop. It was just going to keep on going. And we lost, leading up to that Christmas, 14 man weeks. We had to take two of our senior guys off other things for 7 weeks in order to get to that milestone, which, you know, it actually meant that some of our play pigeons we're going to shoot didn't get shot. So, but that's cool. In case there are, no one's crying anymore. So I'm really just kind of summing it up. You know, it's, you know, don't just immediately go in, oh, look, this is a big load of crap. I've had a look at the first header file and my God, I want to run away from it. Because if it's something that shipped a commercial game, there's got to be some value in there somewhere, you know. And, you know, I went through on the combat system initially. For the first 5 weeks, I did nothing but fix bugs in it. You know, because about 2 weeks into it, I decided, I'll just rip this out. And as soon as I ripped it out, the whole thing fell apart. So I went, okay, I'm going to put that back. Yeah, I never did that. Undo checkout. But in doing that, I realised what all of these little kind of funny messaging things and backdoors and like things sent off to the UI that had to come back, you know, to make all this thing work. And then, you know, once you start to respect how complex these things are, well, then you can work with inside them. So, and that's the last point I've got there. It can actually be a bit of fun. It's kind of like a giant puzzle, some of these things. So, painful, but insanely kind of sadomasochistic, I think. So up to another checkpoint then, want to move on to the processes and practice, a few things that we did do well, and we're looking at improving some of these. You know, Artem, sitting over there, is a mad keen guy on automating everything. We managed to get free stuff from all over the place to run our entire business, nightly build with lump build, fantastic. Good enough, at least, anyway. Artem also set up the continuous integration so that, you know, through the force, every check-in we had, you know, it was validating that. And on the back end of those, we ended up starting to do some auto-run testing. In the middle parts of that, we had to disable that because we had too many asserts going off, and we considered an assert to be a fatal error. So we then had to crack down on that. But, you know, for the, you know, delivering of the game, you know, all of these things started to come in place. So the types of auto-run testing that we did, you know, it was for network desync, because our network model worked the same as the replay system. On one single computer, we could save a replay and then play it back and just check some of the differences, you know, which was a genius thing for not only being able to find these things, but a tool for being able to track down the problems. You know, on one computer, you could sit and just play with it. you know, instead of having to have a whole network session running to try to debug through that. The campaign AI autoplay, how long will the campaign run before it falls over? without playing any battles. Before E3, we had a target of, it had to run 100 turns, and it was running then at over 200 turns. And soon after that, it started finishing pretty much 4 or 5 times, which was great. You know, there's the guys who were working on that, almost enjoyed every day. They got a report saying that it actually went through. The other thing that we used the auto run for, it wasn't exactly auto run, but we used the same facilities to be able to do statistical unit testing of units, not unit code units, so actual units in the game. So if this horse against that knight, I'd expect this kind of outcome, and put it all in a giant matrix, and then run through a series of that. And as soon as some of the numbers started going off, well, was it a code problem? Was it a balance problem? And that was good. The final game is a lot more challenging because we had months and months of trying to get this going together. The other thing that we did do, I thought we did quite well, was just prioritisation. We just constantly prioritised. At no point were we going to shift the end date. We started with a game, so at no point should we have not had a game, so to speak. It's not really an agile thing, but it's kind of a simulated annealing that, in the early days, well, we didn't have enough data, enough work going on to really sit there and do 2-week iterations or anything like that. So the early milestones 1 and 2 that we had, which were about 2 months apart, were a great kind of time to take stock. After that, we looked at every month, reviewed the schedule, looked at people's workloads, looked ahead for potential risks and things that we need to address. After Christmas, we started going to 2 weeks. I'd sit there every Tuesday morning after people had written off what was on there and rebalanced the schedule. Leading up to Alpha, which was also E3 for us, which was a fun time, it was every week. So every Tuesday, just sitting there going through it. We had another milestone that we included between Alpha and Beta, just called Lockdown, which was everybody just hands off. Because what is an Alpha and what is a Beta? Lockdown to us meant no more anything. It was just bug fixing from then on, which was really cool. And then after that, well, we looked at the critical bug list every week, and then leading up to Goldmaster every day, the QA guys would come and sit with us and go, these are really important, this has to be on right now. So kind of faster and faster iterations of prioritisation as we went through. And at the whole point, we went back to our original goal and our original focus that we had to help us with the prioritisation. How do you put feature A over feature B? Well, you go back to your customers and work out what's going to add the biggest value to them. The other thing with scheduling then, we never went and exploded out the whole schedule for the next 2 years. You've got no clarity over what you're going to do 12 months from now, so really we only scheduled up to the next milestone, which was the worst case was 3 months. And even the stuff closer to the milestone didn't have to be in as much detail as the stuff that you were going to do for the next 2 weeks. So we had a very level of detail approach to the way the schedule was run. In conjunction with the constant reprioritisation, if we've got a nasty surprise, like, oh shit, this thing that we thought was going to be 20 days is now 150, well, we could then decide, is the 150 actually worth it, and should we bump other stuff off that is no longer going to make it into the game? And there were a few cases where we did do that, because they were necessary, more than choice. But I haven't put it in this thing, but I've got a saying, there's no such thing as a good surprise. Absolutely. So we actually let people have a 60-day task, and as they got to it, they'd peel off 3 days and they'd spend that to do the investigation, the design, and whatever prototyping or playing with the code they needed to do, and then they'd actually break down what was going to happen. And that 60 sometimes turned into 40, sometimes turned into 120. But inside that, we'd break down all of the micro tasks into priorities as well. So there was stuff that really had to get done, stuff we'd like, and stuff that would be really cool if you ever got around to it. Some of the other things that we kind of said, don't pad your estimates, because if one person pads on another person, then it pads, and then by the time you get to doing all of your project management and your extrapolation of things, which we did do, we looked at effective overall team work rate, which is kind of like velocity, I suppose. and projected that down to a point. We then went back and said, okay, how many features are we going to get done in that time before the game shifts? And which got tighter and tighter as we got closer. But you know, all of this kind of stuff, I mean, especially the last one, and like I know nobody ever fudges their timesheet, but you know, it's just so easy to go, oh yeah, I'm sure I'll pick up a day next week. And before you know it, it's like being at the casino and you've lost everything. And that's when no such thing as a good surprise comes along. Yeah. The other thing that we had a look at was really putting the brakes on and knowing when to stop. You know, a game the size of Medieval 2, ginormous. You know, we could have kept on adding features here and there and fixing. In the end, it came down to we could have kept on fixing stuff probably for the next 6 months. All minor stuff, you know, but you know, there are things that you know people would get a little kind of irked at every now and again. Oh, you know, why doesn't the mouse look around in a bit more smooth than it is? You know, it's a feel thing. It's not a hard bug, but you know, it would certainly add to the quality of the product. When to stop? The answer is simple: as soon as you can. You know, as soon as you've reached a point where you think that your key value statements are now true, you've achieved them, well then stop and just refine those and get it out the door. Because you know, we're not living in a day where you know this is going to be the last project you ever do. You know, there's franchises, there's you know, there's add-ons, there's sequels, there's all that kind of stuff. You know, so and we left a lot of great ideas on the table. You know, not only because they weren't finished. Some of them were just too buggy. For instance, there's no AI in the multiplayer. You can't put an AI army in a multiplayer battle because, you know, when we started putting it through all of our testing, it was just a complete nightmare. You know, there were too many holes, too many leaks, too many desyncs. So we actually, right at the end, we cut it. And there's a couple of cool features that are coming in the expansion pack that that I would have liked to have seen go into Medieval 2, but they're coming. So, you know, it's not a big deal, you know. Take a hard line, just lock it and cut it. And definitely lock out the asset guys. Oh, you know, Jeff isn't here, is he? I'm the audio director. Just one more change. You know, just one speech theme or just one change to a song or one more song variant. That one more little thing might be the thing that exposes a bug that is really nasty. So just lock them out, send them on a holiday. We actually had all of our art guys for the last 2 weeks, sitting and testing, they supplemented the QA department. And great, they took a really gameplay oriented instead of a functional oriented view, and so we got a much better coverage that way, which was fantastic. So, you know, in summary, there, you know, set yourself a goal, make it nice and crisp, and allow that to be the thing that the team can focus on in order to make sure that whatever work they do, whatever features they do, whatever stuff they think they might generalise or leave a hook open for, they're always thinking about what that goal is. You know, and on Medieval 2, the goal was to do one for the fans. You know, we weren't going to go out there and you know just do stuff because we felt like it. We weren't going to innovate. We weren't going to change the Total War formula. The key features, you know, choose a few headliners and invest all you can into it. You know, because that's going to impact the first 5, 10, 15 minutes of the player experience. You know, that's when they're going, I've paid my $100, what am I going to get for it? So, and when they say to their mates, look, I bought Medieval 2, it's cool because of blah. You know, if it was like, oh, I bought Medieval 2 because I'm a history geek, you don't kind of, you know, run in the same circles that way. So, you know, give your customers something to be proud of. The legacy code thing, you know, there's more value than you might think. And in terms of processes and practices, be disciplined but also flexible. The publishers don't like you, you know, the whole flexibility thing, but they really like the fact it came out on time. So, you know, we were very transparent with Sega, and three times they threatened to come and shut us down. Well, that's cool. You know, we're all forgiven now. So, okay, so I wanted to open up for a Q&A. I've got a question. What's next? Just so that I could get the first question in. The Creative Assembly here in Brisbane is continuing on with you know, Medieval 2 products. There's a long stream of stuff coming, which should be very exciting for our customers. And as well as we're looking at starting something new. So I can't really say anything about it at the moment, but if you kind of picture, you know, massive battles and the power of the new console hardware, well, it should give you a bit of a picture. So, questions? Yes?
Has any of you talked to fans a lot in the first game to this one? How did you balance, or how did you figure out what hardcore fan wanted in the game as opposed to casual? It's something that someone who plays a lot of is something that might actually make it even worse.
Oh, absolutely. See, you need to take a very broad spectrum approach and where you get your information from. If we just hunted on the forums, well, we'd only get the hardcore guys, and we would be working on multiplayer campaigns, you know, which 10 guys in the world would play, you know, by mail or carry pigeon or whatever. You know, would be the slowest form of way of communicating that stuff around. We also consult with our marketing department at Sega. You know, they do. They actually in April did a huge market survey on the brand value of Total War, as well as specifically for Medieval 2. And there was lots of great and equally disturbing stuff that came out of that. So across the multiple territories, they did the US, the UK, and Germany, which are the three big strategy markets. So we've got both kind of formal ways of getting feedback, as well as we do have guys who want the forums. And it is a part of, you know, that involvement on the forums is part of our strategy moving forward. So. Cool. Yes?
Did you write the sorts of maps for your, you say, then do you place them in your documents or something?
Yep. There were a couple of exporters that were written, as well as some plugins directly into Max, built on top of Granny. We licensed Granny from Rad Games, which was a great framework for us to be able to just suck all the data out and put it somewhere into an intermediate format that then we've been crunched later on. So the amount of stuff that we had to put into Max was minimal that way, which really freed up a lot of our time, which was cool. Yeah, Rad Games. We also had Bink and Miles from them, so I think they kind of owe us one, I think. Okay, cool. Well, I've had enough of talking if you've had enough of listening, so thanks for coming.